Golf Today.
And a good Wednesday to you. This is Golf Today. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week Magazine. Last night, the debut of TGL in South Florida. Did you check it out?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think if you're invested in TGL, it probably went about as good as you could possibly have hoped for. There are always going to be people who are probably not in to begin with, weren't persuaded. Those who approached it with an open mind, probably pleasantly surprised by what they saw. It doesn't answer any of the sort of midterm, longer term questions around the kind of the long term viability of it as a product. But I actually thought it was a nice evening's entertainment.
Yeah, I watched for a little over an hour. They had the loud music going. You had some really funky holes, which I kind of liked. I kind of was waiting for each kind of hole to be revealed through the wickets. You had different water features and bunkers. Did you enjoy kind of the architecture?
I would even put it more extreme. Yeah. Than some of the holes were somewhat conventional. I would make it as close to kind of golden tee golf as we can. But where were your boys? They're the demographic. You're an old man. You're not the demographic.
Yeah, my boys were watching tennis. You know, I should have three golfers in the house, but I got three tennis players.
You don't even have one golfer in the house.
this is very true. In case you missed it last night, how about the format? Because it was kind of different from what you see week to week on the PGA Tour. These couple of teams battling 15 holes, each match divided into a couple of sessions. You had three versus three alternate shots, six holes of singles. A couple of teams, they have four players, but only three tee off, starting with the triples and completing the match play and singles. Modern match play scoring system, each hole worth 1 point. The fewest shots win the point. How about those highlights? Because I tell you, some stars were out at the SoFi Center in South Florida. You have the spotlight going, Tiger and Rory, DJ Khaled. All he does is win, win, win. First hole, Shane Lowry getting things underway.
He tweeted that he was nervous. He might actually miss the screen. And I think even you could hit that one, Damon. Heavy with a wedge.
Yeah, if you give me a couple swings at it, this was pure. Because you want to wait to see that tracer, making sure everything's working, and TGL is underway. Applause, a lot of smiles. Now, this is Ludvig Åberg for birdie to win the hole. Bang, right off the start.
And the Bay team takes a 1-0 lead, and then the rump was underway.
And they look good, kind of sharp outfits after a tie on the second. Wyndham Clark now on the third. New York's in for bogey. The hammer is thrown. Is New York going to accept the hammer? They do, so this for double the points.
Wyndham Clark steps up, throws it in.
Hammer time. And the Bay takes a 3-0 lead through three holes. Tiger enjoying it. All right, another win for the Bay at the fourth. This is the par three, fifth from over 30 feet. Ludvig Åberg.
When you see it in person, this green is the coolest part of the setup down there. So many different putts can be created.
A lot of pistons and buttons to make this whole endeavor work. So it's a 5-0 lead. Oh, Tiger, again enjoying himself. He's going to play in week two. Xander going, oh my gosh. You can see a lot of struggle in 2024 for the two-time major champ. Now here's Shane Lowry once again. You see that shot clock in the background there? They're kind of under the gun here, eh?
It's a brave man who'll disrupt Shane Lowry on his pre-shot routine, but the hammer thrower did that. Well, you have to accept it if the hammer is thrown right before a shot.
That's right. You see the undulation, the personality, and there it is. The Bay would go on to win by the 10th hole. Final score, the Bay 9-2 over New York. And this new aspect of golf is underway. Our Rex Hoggard and Ryan Lavner were on site at the SoFi Center taking in the action. They join us now. Great to see you, gentlemen. Rex, listen, we've covered this game for a long time. We were shoulder to shoulder when our buddy Trevor Immelman won the 2008 Masters. What was the vibe like inside in this event that you covered for the first time?
Now, Damon, we established earlier this week that Brian Lavner is the curmudgeon of the group. He's the Grinch, I think was what we referred to him on Monday. So we came up with a new segment for the podcast last night, and it's Love It or Lav It. The idea being that what did we like about something? What did we not like about something. In this particular case, I'm going to go with what I loved about it. And a couple things were the environment inside that arena. It's not huge footprint. It's only about 1,500 fans on property. But if you look at it through a different prism, and as you pointed out, this isn't necessarily for the traditional golfer. This is for, to bring someone new into the game. It was a lot of fun. I did have kids who are 20-somethings in college. They did watch it. They were entertained. They were interested in going down to South Florida and attending one of these events. And you also have to give complete credit to how they pulled off the technology. We all do TV for a living, and we know how difficult that is. And you put this in an environment where you have so many moving parts, the technology, everything that went into the production of the actual event, I think it was very impressive.
Ryan, it had to be a difficult night for you. It's the first time in your career you've ever had to attend something where you've actually aged out of the demographic that people are trying to get to with by making the game younger. But has LIV lost the Golf But Louder space with this?
I think you could probably make that argument. LIV is still obviously closer to PGA Tour competition than what the TGL is going to be. And it was very interesting last night. I received a lot of text messages, as I'm sure you guys did as well. Everyone just sort of looking for feedback on what the experience was like. And overall, the sentiment that I got was like, this was anywhere ranging from this is fine to this is great. I think overall, what TGL did on Tuesday night was deliver on its promise. And I also think it showed a lot of potential. As Rex showed, the technology for, you know, people of my age, people younger, like they're going to be absolutely amazed by what they see. From the simulator to the spotlight, which showed where the ball landed, like it all worked flawlessly. The pace of play, I think, is something that every player, every spectator, every fan watching at home is something that they can gravitate to. Everyone complains about the pace of play on the PGA Tour and how it drags not just on the TV product, but also in person with the shorter attention spans that today's generation has. I think that was such an appealing aspect. But I think what's really going to resonate with the younger viewers, Eamon, is that the players really seem to enjoy themselves. And if all of a sudden TGL becomes this contractual chore, you know, it's going to fail. But as Shane Lowry said afterward, while speaking to us, he said, look, I'm heading into my 17th season as a professional golfer, and it's really hard for me at this point in my career to get up for certain events on the PGA Tour and the DP World Tour. But this was new. This is exciting. This is energizing. It was some of the most fun 2 hours of golf he's ever had. That is something that you want to imbue these players with as they continue over this 3-month season. And that's something that can sort of resonate with fans where maybe LIV has not over the past couple of years.
Rex, I'm fascinated by the shot clock as well. Last time I saw the shot clock, Mikko Korhonen was winning the 2018 Shot Clock Masters. What did you think about the shot clock? I kind of liked it watching it and kind of hit the heartbeat and a little bit of pressure and a little bit of, you know, pace to a sport that can sometimes be a little bit sleepy and slow.
Damon, I am here for 2-hour rounds of golf. I am here all day long for that. And I love the shot clock. And it was interesting when the players talked to us after the matches, all six of them agreed that if you were going to take anything from what happened last night and try to apply it to the PGA Tour, to a real 72-hole stroke play event, it's the 40-second shot clock. And I was fascinated not only by the pace, which I think everybody would admit it's very refreshing, but the idea that it added a level of strategy that you don't normally see. You could see one person, Shane Lowry, teeing off in the teeing zone, and who's ever hitting the next shot is already poised around the green with a putter and a wedge, waiting for that light to come out of the heavens to play his next shot. That puts pressure on the other team. Now they have to play fast. I love that.
Ryan, there was certainly a tremendous amount of curiosity on what this product was going to be for week one. Week two has Tiger playing. Week four has Rory McIlroy playing. Is week three what we ought to be looking at to see what's the audience traction looking like in terms of making it not necessarily appointment viewing, but something that the fan base actually wants to return to for the entertainment value?
I don't know if it's necessarily week three. I think more so late February, early March. What are the ratings then? What is the interest level then? What is the media attention that TGL is still getting then? Like, how do you get people coming back for more than just the initial curiosity and the novelty of what is pretty amazing technology? I think there's sort of two components that are so crucial to this. The players have to be appealing enough. They have to be invested enough. They have to be interesting enough. They have to be entertaining enough. And I think you'll see that as TGL progresses, that players will get more confident. They'll get more comfortable. They can maybe trade barbs a little bit more, even though banter can sort of be one of the most cringy aspects of these made-for-TV exhibitions. I think you can sort of see a little bit more interaction once they start to feel each other out. And I think the second part of this that's going to be really interesting to watch is the competition level. And that's where gambling comes in, the ability to bet in real time. I think you could actually make the argument that the end result might be one of the least interesting aspects of this. It's how you get to that point. And a lot of, you know, I don't think fans are necessarily going to be gravitating towards Jupiter Links or Bay Golf Club. They're going to be interested in watching their favorite players play in a, what is a new, an interesting, and a different style of play, not necessarily the team aspect. And I think that's overall something to watch over these next couple of months.
Rex, were you surprised that while Tiger and Rory were in town and on site, neither one of them was playing? Or does it make sense to you that the general curiosity would have carried week one and you start to roll out the bigger guns after that to sustain the audience?
Yeah, that was clearly the mission that TGL had. And I remember having this conversation with an official last year from TGL pointing out that this was the way they were going to do it. They expected this first match to have sort of a curiosity to it. The people were going to tune in to see the bells and whistles and the technology and the fast pace, and they didn't need Tiger or Rory. And then you look at the way they spaced it out. Next week, it'll be Tiger, and we'll probably get a bigger audience because of that, not just on hand at the SoFi Center, but also, you would think, from a TV viewership standpoint. And then 2 weeks after that, you have Rory and Tiger going head-to-head. So they have maximized the stars that they have. And I'll also point out that one of the things that I really thought was fascinating, and again, this is something I am here for, it's Tiger and Rory being in the booth. I would have liked to have seen them in the booth for the entire telecast, getting their thoughts on what shots they were going to hit, getting their thoughts on the technology and the league itself. I thought that was a very cool element as well.
Lav, anything you change, whether it's the nomenclature, triples, singles, the number of players, the format, or you know, let them kind of find their feet and let them do what they do?
Well, I think, Damon, as it comes to the competition elements that could be improved, look, this is what a hammer looks like. This is what they had in SoFi Center. They need to treat these hammers like they're essentially NFL challenge flags, where you get X number to start the day, and if you win the hammer, you can retain the hammer. Having it alternate did not make any sense to me. I think that is an improvement that could be made probably once every team at least plays once, so you're not having, you know, holes won and lost with different rules. But I think that's something that makes a lot of sense moving forward. One thing that I think I was most surprised by, guys, was the in-person experience, and that it wasn't quite as good as I thought it was. And I think moving forward, I'm going to be more interested to watch it on TV than I would be in person. Obviously, it's visually stimulating with a five-story screen and a rotating green that has pistons in it that can change and be altered. But in person, the experience, there's 1,500 seats. That gets swallowed up pretty quickly by a lot of corporate types. You don't have headsets for spectators who are sitting in their seats, and so you don't hear any of the interaction between players, which I thought was a little bit interesting as well. And there's a lot of dead time during the commercial breaks that almost makes it feel like a little bit of a game show. And then when they're about to come back live, you had Roger Steele sort of hyping up the crowd and making it seem like a lively atmosphere. Yeah. Look, I've covered a lot of bad sporting events. I attend a lot of bad sporting events as a Jacksonville Jaguars season ticket holder. Like, you still have to have some sort of on field or on course or on stage promotion during that dead time to make sure the crowd is engaged. And it's a great 2 hour experience for the on-site fan as well. And not just the folks at home.
It's coming up later this year, the Ryder Cup, Bethpage Black. That's on the agenda right here after the break, as we talk with the new leaders atop the PGA of America. We'll be right back.
Golf Today. Brought to you by WinGrips, the best grips in golf. Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
The PGA Tour completes its two-week stretch in Hawaii this week at Wailea Country Club in the state capital of Honolulu. That's the host to the Sony Open, the first fertile field event on the PGA Tour for 2025, and Wailea has been home to this tournament since it began back in 1965. And as we said, it's the first full field event of the season, and every start counts this season. It's the second of 36 regular season FedEx Cup events, but of course only the top 70 players in the FedEx Cup standings will qualify for the playoffs. That change made a couple of years ago. Only the top 100 will be fully exempt for 2026, and in 2026, the policy board has already reduced the field sizes. at a number of events. And Todd Lewis joins us now from Hawaii. And Todd, some new names in the field this week for the first full field event of the year.
Yeah, new names and new members. There are 32 rookies on the PGA Tour and three first-year members on tour as well. Those three, those are players that have had more than seven starts on the PGA Tour and are now members. So a total of 35 in all, 25 from that group here at the Sony Open in Hawaii, making their debut as members. Now, of course, they are realizing a dream that has come true for them, but at the same time, as we have seen over the last couple of years from Ludvig Åberg, Nick Dunlap, Matt McCarty, many of these first-year players are ready to make an immediate impact.
I'm super pumped, you know. Have been lucky to have the opportunity to play in a couple events before, a couple U.S. Opens, and but to be playing here as a member is really special. And, you know, the offseason felt a little long, so definitely excited to get after it and get competing again.
What do you expect from yourself this year?
Oh, I think for me it's really just doing my best and having fun. I mean, it's such a treat to be out here, and I'm incredibly blessed to be here and playing the game I love. So other than that, you know, I expect to, you know, just do my best. And, you know, I've had some good results the past couple of years, and looking forward to just kind of keep stacking some learning and really just do my best.
What are you most looking forward to this season?
It's a good question. I would say proving myself over the last decade of traveling the world that I've learned a lot, and it's going to help prepare me to be the most prepared rookie, I guess, as a 36-year-old rookie could be, and enjoy, you know, taking those lessons and applying them to the PGA Tour and having a really great year.
How would you define a great year?
My goal this year would probably be somewhere between top 50 and top 70 FedEx Cup list. That's my kind of dream goal for the year. Would love to, you know, we all say this, but would love to get a win. And I felt like I've done it on every level and want to prove to myself that I can do it on this one as well.
Super excited. I've had a hard time sleeping the last couple of nights, but it's awesome to be here. I mean, it's at the end of the day, it's just golf, and that's kind of how I'm treating it. But practicing the same way I did on the Korn Ferry Tour and planning on doing the same thing I did last year.
What are you expecting from yourself this year?
I expect to have a lot of fun, honestly. I don't expect to win, but I know that my caddy and I have a really good game plan for the year, and I think we can do it. A lot of courses set up really well for us, and I think we have a really good chance of finishing in the top 50 this year.
Look where we are. Can't get much better than this, and, you know, I have some family ties here, so I get to have some family come out and watch, and my parents are going to come out and watch, so it's going to be really special, for sure.
This is a long season. How do you mentally prepare for what the battle is out there?
I mean, just stick to the process, stick to your own game. I think the one thing is I've done really well is, you know, stay true to myself and do what works for me. I think I haven't really focused too much on other people and be like, you know, oh, that he's doing this, I should do that, something like that. Just very much just stayed my own lane and, you know, focused on myself, and I feel like that's worked out really well for me.
What do you expect from yourself this year?
Honestly, I don't know. You know, I'm just really excited to be out here. I've been, you know, dreaming of this ever since I was a kid. You know, just all the tournaments, all the, you know, excitement. It's just all pouring out of me right now. I'm just so excited. But, you know, just really just want to, you know, have a solid year and just, you know, obviously keep my card, and that'd be, you know, a solid start.
You heard Ricky Castillo talk about the fact that he does have ties to Hawaii. His grandmother grew up on Lanai, and although Ricky lived in California and grew up there, his grandmother came over and supported him as a young player trying to make it to the PGA Tour, which he has done. And he is remembering her with a puka shell necklace here this week as he makes his first start on the PGA Tour as a member. So there are a lot of young players here, but there are some veterans competing at the Sony Open in Hawaii. One of them is Webb Simpson. He's going to turn 40 this summer. Of course, he has seven wins on the PGA Tour, which includes a Players and the U.S. Open. He hasn't won, though, since 2020. Now, he's had some things off the course that he's had to manage. First, he's got five beautiful children. And secondly, he's been a player director on the PGA Tour for the board, trying to get through some new changes that have been implemented this year, and also the continuing negotiations with the PGA Tour and the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia. So that has taken some time from him. But still, though, he feels like he does have enough time to work on his game and some fire in his belly to compete here on the tour once again.
Maybe a couple years ago when I cut back a little and I wasn't playing as much or wasn't playing as well, I think at first I was thinking, man, do I really love the game like I used to? And I think after a while, kind of consulting with a mentor of mine, I realized I do love the game. I love competing. Like when I actually think about how I feel when I'm at a PGA Tour event for Thursday through Sunday inside the ropes, like I love it as much as ever. And I have a desire to get in contention more than ever. But having these other things, whether it's family or ministry stuff or Ryder Cup, those things I have a lot of love for. I think sometimes they can feel like they're competing, you know, in my mind and heart. But I think there's a way to do both. There's a way to still try to compete at a high level. And, you know, I've talked to Steve Stricker over the years. He did a wonderful job of playing less, but still playing at a high level. And I'm also growing a ton of respect for him because he did it for a number of years. I realized how hard it actually is to play 10 or 12 times a year. He remained, I think, top 10 or 15 of the world. And so I certainly hadn't played the level I've wanted to play at. But, you know, some guys will play and kind of survive for a number of years. I feel like I don't have enough patience. And so if I can't turn around my game sooner rather than later, I don't know how long I want to struggle.
Webb has had some success here in Honolulu, 4 top 10s and 15 starts at the Sony Open. Interestingly, he has 2 swing coaches, one being Joe Mayo. The other is his longtime friend and caddy, Paul Tesori, who is now in the bag of Tom Kim. Webb, a couple of years ago, said he wasn't going to play as much on the PGA Tour and wanted Paul to have an opportunity to be on a young player's bag, which he is with Tom Kim. But I saw Paul yesterday working with Webb, giving him some drills to get ready for the Sony Open. And I mentioned all the off-the-course stuff that Webb Simpson has to manage. He is also an assistant captain to Keegan Bradley for the U.S. Ryder Cup team, so time management is the essence for Webb Simpson's success here in 2025, guys.
You know, Todd, we're not at all resentful looking at that backdrop behind you when it's 25 degrees here. But despite all that resentment, we are going to check in with you a little bit later in the show. We'll be right back.
We celebrate the 30th anniversary of the network. So many hardworking folks have helped grow the channel, which started way back in January of 1995. And arguably nobody was more instrumental in getting the channel started than co-founder Joe Gibbs, who went into business with Arnold Palmer more than 30 years ago. Joe was key in raising the funds to keep the network going in the early years. And yesterday, Joe caught up with Rich Lerner and gave his thoughts on the channel's impact.
There's a story, sort of a boardroom tale with Arnold and the skeptics that is now the stuff of lore, at least in our world.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, everyone, all the articles that you were reading at that time were negative articles, and they were telling us that, you know, this will never work. And I had been out for 2 years now looking for the big money to be able to launch the channel. Arnold's advisors were telling him that this is just going to be too risky. You can't do it. And he called me and he said, we got to talk. So I flew to Bay Hill. We met in the boardroom, and several of his advisors and lawyers were there. And I gave them the speech of why he shouldn't quit and what we were doing and how far we had come. And finally, Arnold looked around the room and said to no one in particular, but he said, guys, if I hadn't have tried to hit it through the trees a few times, none of us would be here. Mm. And after that, they just all shut up. And he was committed from that day forward.
What does Golf Channel mean to the sport 30 years after you launched it with Arnold, Joe?
Well, it's a little self-serving the way I feel about that. But I feel like that the channel means a lot to the entire industry in every aspect. The advertisers have an endemic channel that they can use to advertise. The audience, of the instruction, travel, and everything you can think about in the facet of the game is enhanced by this channel. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I'm a little biased, but I think it's true.
Thank you, Joe Gibbs. Thank you, Arnold Palmer. As we go to break, we celebrate all the people who have passed through these doors. We are grateful. 30 years. Wow. Golf Today continues after this.
The last time we saw Bryson DeChambeau, he was playing an exhibition match in Las Vegas, and it was too cold for small talk. We'll hear from the US Open champion as he talks about the future for LIV guys on the PGA Tour and whether he expects to be part of Keegan Bradley's team at the Ryder Cup. And Brad Faxon is in the house for a past champions chat. We're going to kick around the state of the game with the 8-time PGA Tour winner. He was at the TGL launch last night, so we'll ask if he likes what's new and shiny. Golf Today continues right now.
Golf Today.
Welcome back into Golf Today's second hour. I'm Eamon Lynch alongside Damon Hack. We did hear from the new leadership of the PGA of America earlier, Don Rae, the president, Derek Sprague, the new CEO. It was interesting hearing Derek talk about the rollback. Clearly, the PGA of America is not on board as the previous leadership of the organization wasn't. It's going to be interesting to see how they choose to push that in terms of their own championships, because as far as the governing bodies are concerned, the new distance guidelines are settled law.
You might need a 330-yard drive to play Bethpage Black successfully. That, of course, the site of the Ryder Cup. I just can't wait. I moved to New York in the year 2000. I worked for the Long Island paper, Newsday. Big-time sports in this part of the world, it's always must-see TV. But this is going to be loud. It's going to be intense. I imagine it'll be a lot of patriotism, and it'll be a lot of noise. I'm a little concerned. There's excitement and pride as someone who loves this part of the world. There's a little bit of trepidation as well, just because it's going to be a lot of pageantry and a lot of chest poked out.
Yeah, and with Bethpage, as we found out in the past, you always have to be slightly concerned about whether things cross a line there.
Right.
And when the pricing issue, which the leaders also addressed, came out, with ticket prices basically costing almost $1,000 a day for tournament days, that's going to alienate a lot of fans who clearly aren't going to be able to afford to go. But does it embolden the fans who do go to then believe that they are part of the entertainment?
That's like, you know, dinner
and a show
in Midtown.
To be here. I'm part of the show.
No doubt.
And that's always a fine line at Bethpage and Ryder Cups at the best of times.
Yes, we're still a long way away from September and Long Island. Right now, the PGA Tour in Hawaii. Yes, the Hawaii Swing rolls on. Honolulu is the site for the Sony Open in Hawaii. Live first round coverage comes your way tomorrow, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. More pretty pictures coming your way. It was a record-breaking Sunday at the Century as Hideki Matsuyama's 35 under par now stands as the lowest score in relation to par in a 72-hole event. The win was his 11th on the PGA Tour. He moves to number 5 in the official world golf ranking, number 1 in the FedEx Cup standings. And yeah, joins this list. To hear him tell it, he wanted both, and now he's won of 7 to win both Hawaii events. You see Ernie Els doing it in the same year, Justin Thomas as well. Todd Lewis joins us once again from Wildlife. Todd, last week's champ. If I'm him, I'm not doing anything different as he looks to go back to back, but is there anything new with Hideki this week?
Well, Damon, it could be. First, let's go back to last Sunday, and he gets that 35 under par, which becomes the all-time scoring record for a tournament on the PGA Tour. And there were some questions as to whether or not Hideki knew that number going into that final round. And according to his team, yeah, he was aware. He studies sports. He loves baseball. He knows the ERA and the batting averages of all the great players. So he was aware, and he was very excited to become put himself in the history books as that all-time leading score winner, a 35 under par on the PGA Tour for a tournament. Now, what happened after the win? Well, he and his team had a celebratory dinner on Maui, but didn't last too long because they jumped on a flight and hopped over here to Oahu to get ready for the Sony Open in Hawaii. Now, Monday was supposed to be a rest day, just relax, but Hideki was itching to get back out and practice a little more, which he did. And he practiced, interestingly enough, with a different putter than the one that he used to win the Century. And, of course, that putter was a center shaft putter. This putter that he practiced with on Monday was more of a conventional neck putter. And on Tuesday, he was out playing a practice round, but he had that new putter with the center shaft in his bag, and he was using that, but the other putter was in his bag as well. So it'll be interesting to see which putter he uses come Thursday. Now, in Tokyo, it's 19 hours ahead of Honolulu, so it was mid-morning on Monday when Hideki Matsuyama won his 11th PGA Tour victory on the PGA Tour, and there was a bit of buzz, a bit of an excitement in his home country of Japan, because not only did he win for the 11th time, but of course setting that scoring record as well. And I asked his manager, Bob Turner, where is Hideki on the ladder of sports athletes rather that have popular following in Japan? And he said that, you know, outside of Ohtani, who's that great baseball player for the LA Dodgers, he is number two probably. So he's immensely popular in Japan, and it was quite exciting for folks in his home country when he got that 11th victory last week. Guys?
Shohei Ohtani, member of the World Series champion Los Angeles Dodgers, T. Lee reporting from Honolulu. Have a great week, pal.
Thank you.
Well, it would be hard to top this one as the most memorable moment of the year. Bryson DeChambeau topping in for that U.S. Open victory after that epic bunker shot secured a one-stroke victory over Rory McIlroy at Pinehurst number two and gave him his second U.S. Open title after the winged foot victory back in 2020. And he had a solid year in the majors. T6 at the Masters, runner-up to Xander Schauffele at the PGA Championship, won that U.S. Open, but then knocked around a little bit by Royal Troon. And earlier today, Bryson caught up with Gary Williams on the Five Clubs podcast to give his thoughts on the current state of the game.
I got a tremendous opportunity over here at LIV Golf to promote YouTube, my YouTube channel, and promote the crushers of what I've been trying to create for the past couple years. It's been an upward battle to get to where we're at today. But you can see the likes of, you know, the crushers and then Reebok obviously doing what they're doing with us now. And, you know, the dominoes are kind of starting to fall, which has been fun to see the transition of companies and how they view LIV Golf. And I feel like there's space in this ecosystem, this great game of golf, to have multiple ways to consume professional golf. And I really think it's just an additive at the end of the day. Ultimately, it will be an additive. We're obviously working the details out of that right now. But long story short, this disruption, I think, will ultimately be good for the professional game. It's just going to take a little bit of time.
The global golf consumer, what do you think they want?
I personally think they want entertainment. From what I've seen, they want to see cool shots, cool entertainers, interesting people. They want storylines. They want to feel a part of something that's bigger than just their small little community. They want to be a part of this global golf landscape. And I think that's what's really cool. Going to Hong Kong for the first time last year was eye-opening to me. Adelaide, seeing how many golf fans are in Adelaide and the thousands and thousands that showed up to watch us and root us on and be crazy and throw stuff around and interact with us was really cool to see that, yeah, the American sport that we know and love, that's golf, is great. It's fantastic. And we want to continue to bolster that relationship with the American golf consumption, but it's so much bigger outside as well.
A couple thoughts from you about this year. My feeling is that the only thing that's going to matter is performance as it relates to you or anybody else on LIV and the Ryder Cup in the United States. Yeah. Do you think that's what it's going to be, that we're not going to have to deal with anything that is intangible, that it is going to be strictly about performance metrics and you at Bethpage?
I hope so. I believe so. Keegan has been very responsive to numerous players over here, and it's been quite fun to see him, in a sense, back us, but give us the opportunity to say, hey, if you play well, you're going to be there. And it really gives us a bit of momentum to feel like, okay, this year we got to perform. You know, every major we have to perform no matter what. This is, we're going to be playing for our country again. And I think that's what's so cool about that opportunity.
Last thing about LIV and the PGA Tour. Do you think that 2025 could see anybody, yourself or anybody else, on the PGA Tour in an event, or a PGA Tour player putting their toe in the water in LIV, or is that premature in 2025?
I'm not one to say the future of golf, but I wouldn't put it past anyone. I think there is unique conversations going on. I hope that's the case. I hope that over the course of time, we're able to go back and forth. And playing events, you know, that I loved, and then vice versa, coming out and showcasing themselves internationally at a place that they've always wanted to go. I think there's a great place for this amazing game. There's enough space in this ecosystem. I don't believe we should be pigeonholing ourselves to this game and splitting up the game, you know, and keeping it that way. I think that this cohesiveness in the game of golf is what's needed in order to move the professional sport forward.
You know, Bryson can go. He's going to talk. You know, you ask him a question, he's going to throw out a lot of different things. I'm more interested in what's going on with Bryson inside the ropes, and he's earned Ryder Cup consideration. T6 at the Masters, second at the PGA, a second U.S. Open title in June. You know, no one really knows what's going to happen, when this deal's going to happen, who's going to be able to play where. But Keegan Bradley, you know, would probably be out of his mind not to consider how Bryson has played and how I expect Bryson to continue to play in 2025, especially when it comes to the majors.
Well, that's all how it looks on paper, but the Ryder Cup has historically always also been a what have you done for me lately
kind
of scenario. I mean, John Daly twice won majors in Ryder Cup years and never got a captain's pick and never qualified for a team. I would think that Bryson DeChambeau is going to have to earn it to some extent. He is going to have to still continue to play well. You can absolutely make the argument he deserves it because there were not many better players than him in the major championships last year. And you would also think that Keegan Bradley would be crazy not to want to weaponize Bryson in that kind of environment. Now, in the past, we've seen Bryson get kind of thrown off a little bit by the basic cruelty of some fans out there as well. And that element will be at Bethpage, but that element's probably going to be on his side at Bethpage. So he would certainly be additive to that. On the other points he was making, I'm not necessarily as convinced yet that all of this disruption will ultimately be better for the game of golf. We'll see. We know it's better for golfers. We know it's better for the bank balances of certain golfers. It has not been good for fans. Is it going to get to the point where it's good for fans in some kind of reunified world? It's very possible. There are certainly a lot of people who seem more optimistic on that front for sure. And, you know, Gary raised that interesting question. Do you see the potential for LIV guys appearing on the PGA Tour or vice versa? That's a really valid question that will be getting addressed here, because if there is going to be a deal between the Saudis and the PGA Tour, and they all seem incentivized towards that deal, but what's the bridge to get there? Because it's a long time to work out the details and particulars of what the new landscape is going to look like. It ain't happening in 2025. It may not even happen in time for 2026 season, given how much would have to go into that. But what's the bridge period until then? And do you see a Bryson or a Brooks or someone else, John Rahm, show up and play in PGA Tour events? I don't think it's out of the question at all.
And golf has its diehard fans, but what's the bridge back to the fans who are tired of the storyline and who have turned off the television, or if they haven't turned off the television, they've changed the channel to a different sport or a different endeavor or streaming, you know, a show on Netflix or some, you know, streaming outlet and not watching golf anymore. I love the passion of the golf fans who have stayed, but there's no guarantee that the golf fans who have been offended or turned off or who are weary, you're going to have to work to get them back as well. Maybe some people will have a short memory and won't care about the last couple of years, but there's no guarantee, despite all of the entreaties and outreach that I hope happens, that the fans that left will come back.
There's absolutely no guarantee they'll come back, but I guess then again the question becomes, what are you serving up to the fans who have stayed and who have remained with this product? And if there is to be that bridge period, well then perhaps serving up a Bryson DeChambeau or a Brooks Koepka or a John Rahm or someone else in a tournament setting that they're currently not eligible for.
Right.
I mean, that's simply, the fans will have a short memory on this. The fans have not embraced LIV. They are not going to embrace LIV. It's a toxic, failed product. They do embrace the players, though, as individuals. They clearly embraced Bryson last year, and they've embraced Koepka as well, and even to some extent Phil Mickelson still, and Rahm. So those guys could potentially be embraced in a PGA Tour setting at some point going forward. I think you're going to get to a point where the appearances of those guys is separated somewhat from the tour that they're actually playing on most of the time. That, to me, seems the most likely scenario for a bridge to the future.
When you win a U.S. Open for the second time, I think you become more Bryson DeChambeau and less Bryson DeChambeau of LIV. And does he deserve some credit? Because, listen, for a time, people were making fun of him, you know, twitching at all hours and doing his outreach on YouTube. I mean, look at him now. Look at the fan base that he has built. In some ways, was he ahead of
the... You think he wants to be at TGL last night? Isn't that kind of his setting?
I mean, it is his setting, and maybe he deserves some credit for alternative ways for golf fans to look at the sport. Hitting flip wedges over his house, you know, and answering questions online. And maybe in some ways, he deserves some credit for that and would benefit whatever this ultimate professional golf landscape looks like.
He's definitely the guy, I think you could make an argument that going to LIV was probably a good move for him, because he was trapped in this kind of social media vortex on the PGA Tour, and it was not a comfortable existence for him. A lot of it, admittedly, was self-inflicted. He enjoys and embraces that world, but it's a tough hang out there on social media, and Bryson was bruised a lot out there.
He was.
His ability to sort of build up his own kind of content stable or his own ecosystem around him. I still think he's a little too invested in the image of that ecosystem, but it allowed him a certain kind of freedom and space to develop a personality that he wasn't really getting on the PGA Tour. And fans do embrace him. He is arguably in the top two or three most engaging people in this game. Some players or fans really love him. Some really don't like him at all, but that's the very nature of engagement, and the game is lesser when we don't see him as much.
Speaking of Brad Faxon, still ahead on Golf Today, it's time for a Past Champs Chat Hawaii edition with that putting fool. Cruise to a 2001 title at the Sony. We're taking a trip down memory lane on the other side of the break. Swing continues this week on the island of Oahu. Live first round coverage of the Sony Open comes your way Thursday. That's tomorrow, 7 p.m. Eastern time, right here on Golf Channel.
Well, it's time for a little stroll down memory lane. Let's look back to 2001 Sony Open. Brad Faxon secured a wire-to-wire victory at Wailea Country Club. Final round 65 to match the lowest 72-hole score in tournament history and win by 4 shots. That was the 7th of 8 career PGA Tour victories for Brad Faxon. He had a couple more on the senior circuit. He's played 2 Ryder Cup teams, Australian Open champion. That was at the Great Metropolitan Golf Club back in 1993. Also a Walker Cup team member. So it's time now for a Past Champions Chat as we welcome in Brad, who's coming to us from Jupiter Hills Club down in Florida, where he is no doubt giving some students the secret of putting that he refuses to share with me. Brad, you won that week 20 under par. You won by 4 shots. Where does that rank among the meaningful victories for you?
I would say, Eamon, that was the best golf that I played in my career. They had changed the par that year from 71 to 70, so the par was 280 for the 72-hole aggregate, and I shot 20 under par. The highlight, really, other than winning, was I eagled one of the 2 par 5s every single day, and that putt that you just showed was on the final, the hole on Sunday. I played the last 2 rounds with Ernie Els and Tom Lehman when they were, I think, top 5, maybe at least top 10 players in the world. So to be able to shoot that low under par, to finish with an eagle for 4 consecutive rounds. And when you showed right before we went to commercial, the kiss from my wife, Dory, that's one of the best celebration kisses from a couple I've seen. I love seeing that. And we were newly married back then, and this year it'll be our 25th anniversary.
Happy 25th anniversary, little smooching on Golf Channel. You'll love to see it. And I love that you mentioned Lehman and Else, because Tom said they threw everything at you and you had an answer every time. Is a win a little bit sweeter when you're beating two major champs who really were still at the height of their power?
Well, I had a lot of good things happen that week. Amy will like this because I was working with a teaching professional there that nobody really knew, named Ron Gring, and he gave me some tips that week that everything clicked. And that Wylie is one of the hardest courses to actually hit the fairways, one of the only courses that uses regular Bermuda grass there, not some of the new strains of Bermuda grass. And hitting from the fairway is really important that week because of the small greens in the wind. And I'll tell you what, you know, me hitting fairways when I could chip and putt was pretty dangerous. But on the final round, one of the fairways I missed was on the tough second hole. I blew my second shot way to the left. The pin was way to the right. And I chipped in across the green from some gnarly rough. And Els, I remember looking at Ernie, he just kind of shook his head, like put his hands up. And we had just started that final round. So, and, you know, both of those guys were open champions. Both guys knew how to play in the wind. And we had, you know, certainly a good gallery there at Wylie. And the memories of going back to Honolulu every year and having that victory is certainly a highlight. And I know this is a big week for a lot of the players that play there this week, a lot of the rookies that play that are begging and need starts. To get off to a good start is critical, particularly this year.
Just on that subject, Brad, obviously it's gone down now to the top 100 guys will keep fully exempt status on the PGA Tour. Back when you went out there in 83, that was around the time that they actually started the fully exempt tour, and the number wasn't particularly high all the way back before those days. Are you a fan of what you see in terms of the coming changes? I know from conversations you understand why it's happening. Are you a believer in it, I guess, as a competitor?
Yeah, so 1983, I went through the qualifying school. We had, you know, kind of a new all-exempt tour. Gary McCord helped to create that. You know, Dean Beeman was the commissioner, and I played all six rounds at Sawgrass, at the TPC at Sawgrass, which was for your life, and what a hard stroke play course that was back then. And when you went through the qualifying school, you got 50 spots, and we knew that the early starts were important to get some status, to keep your status so you could keep playing. They reshuffled the players through the Q school. And now that there's only 100 spots, you have designated series events, that the signature events that the young players aren't necessarily going to even get a chance to get in. They're going to have to qualify for a U.S. Open, for a British Open, for the PGA, and various different ways. So, I haven't really wrapped myself around whether this is better for golf. I know it's better for the better player. But when I was playing, Damon, one more thing, that Jim Colbert, who was on the PGA Tour's policy back then, you know, had one slogan or one line that he liked to use, and he said, play better. And whatever the system is that the PGA Tour has, it's never going to stop the best players in the world from getting out there and becoming elite players. But it certainly sounds like this will be much tougher for the younger guys.
Speaking of the best players in the world, how about the best player, world number one, Scottie Scheffler? Brad, what did you think when you saw him break out that claw grip at the Hero? You know, he won 7 times on the PGA Tour last year, 8 if you include the Olympics, 9 if you include the Hero, and how he wielded that putter with great confidence.
Well, there's a lot to talk about there. I think, first of all, his team with Phil Kenyon, who's one of the best putting coaches in the world and teaches a lot of great players, that they would go ahead and investigate, where can I improve? Where can I find a tenth of a stroke? And maybe that tenth of a stroke isn't just for a round. Maybe it's for a tournament. And when you divide all the distances that players putt from, and I was with Mark Brody last night at the TGL event, who came up with all these ideas on strokes gained, they found out, look, maybe you should use this grip for the closer in putts where you've had the, you know, your ranking isn't the best there. That's an easy place to look to try and improve. And when he went to that claw grip, he started using a lot of putts a lot longer than that too. So it certainly has worked out for him, and he looks unbeatable.
Just going back to that TGL event that you attended last night, Brad, and I know that was after your bedtime, so congratulations on actually making that. But we've had a long-running joke for years that you used to lead the tour in adjacent fairways hit. Do you think you could have hit that screen in the SoFi Arena last night with a driver?
Well, first of all, I stayed there till 11 o'clock. You told me you went to sleep at 10:45, so you can't do that. That screen is giant, Eamon. You couldn't even miss this thing on your worst of hits. But it's such an impressive venue. And I was asked on the Michael Breed show on PGA Tour Radio this morning, when you go in live to this arena, it is an arena, it's a stadium. It was a $70 million construction project. And from outside, it looks like there's technology outside. There's all the signs that you might see in the most well-known basketball, hockey arenas. And then when you get inside, it's brand new. The technology's on the outside before you go inside to see, you know, you've never seen an indoor golf space this big with a regulation size putting green that's on kind of a turntable that can move around and be adjusted with slopes. All those holes that you see on the screen were almost like artificial intelligence design. They're not real golf courses. I think the players that are playing in this really, they like it. And the anticipation these players see when you see the trace of the ball coming up there, you don't actually know where it's going to land on the way down. There's the hold your breath moment there as we look as Rory, Tiger, and I believe that's McCarley, the founder, in the owner's box. It was a pretty cool spectacle to be there for the first time last night.
Yeah, it was neat seeing Rory there. Rory, obviously a fan favorite. You've worked with Rory for several years now with his putting. Can you give us a little bit of a preview on what we might see from Rory McIlroy in his game as he chases that elusive fifth major championship?
Well, exactly. You know, he had some statistics shown to him from his team at TaylorMade about how good he is. And he had a sensational putting year again. And, you know, these top players that hit the ball so well, like Scotty, like Xander, like Rory, they don't have to be the best putters on the tour to be the best players in the world. You've seen that from Scotty this year. He was in the averages for most of the tour players, be dominating like he was. And for Rory, he was sensational from 0 to 6 feet, last year. And he doesn't have to change much. There's always a little bit of a temptation to go try and, maybe I need to do a lot of different things like Scotty did with his grip. Rory's driven it perfectly. The best of any player in the strokes gained error. He's a tour leader off the tee. He does need to sharpen, and I think he's been doing it a little bit with his wedge game, wedge distances. I think Rory knows that he probably played a tournament or two too much last year, and that might just calm down a little bit. But Rory's in great spirits right now. I think what he did with his longtime coach, Michael Bannon, at the end of the year to get that club on a little bit of a better plane so that he can go at it better will ultimately help not only keep his driving great, but help the short shots as well. And I think what makes Rory so mystical in a way is how can a guy hit it so hard now that he's 35, he hasn't lost any speed. As a matter of fact, you'll see some of his ball speeds up at 185 plus 187 while he's actually out on the course.
Now, Eamon Lynch territory there.
It really is. A scorecard yes, number, it maybe. Brad, do you think there's a little extra difficulty for Rory in 2025 in getting that fifth major just based on the venues and the pressure? Because obviously Augusta is its own burden to try to complete the career Grand Slam there. But you go to the PGA Championship and he's got such a burden there because of the expectation of having won at Quail Hollow multiple times and this idea, well, it's your golf course, you ought to perform well there. And then we've already seen in the past what the pressure at Royal Portrush can actually do to Rory as well, playing under that home crowd. And for that kind of history, it would seem that Oakmont is the only one of the four major venues where there isn't going to be an added weight of pressure on Rory McIlroy other than what he puts on himself.
It can be self-inflicted, can it? I mean, or you can let the media get in your head. I think, you know, you look at Rory's year last year with the four wins that he had worldwide, four second place finishes, there's so many near misses, like you said it, at the U.S. Open at Pinehurst and at County Down. But I think the best players in the world are resilient. They can use those things to teach them. And in a way, I still think Rory's still growing. I would be very surprised if he didn't win a major this year. I don't care which one. I'm sure he doesn't care which one it is. But he's learned a lot. And one of the magic pieces of his team is his trainer, who I know you know. And when I say trainer, that's really the wrong word. But Rohit Sharma, who is with Rory a lot more on the road now, has kept Rory strong. He's kept him injury-free. He's helped him with that. The ball speed, but Rory's trainer is also a guy that's a little bit of a psychologist. They know exactly what they're doing with the amount, the food they eat, when they eat, when they get up, what they do before they practice, before they go out to the course. Remarkable guy. He was there last night watching Rory in the, watching the teams in the TGL, not Rory, but I love Ro. Ro's a great guy. And I just think that Rory's going to have a great year this year. And that he will put a lot less pressure on himself than the rest of the world will.
I saw that duo in the gym in San Antonio, and they were throwing around a lot of weight. Brad, it's great to see you, and looking forward to seeing you during the Florida Swing in 2025. Maybe another party at Casa Faxon.
I can't wait. I know you and I are always in that gym before most people, Damon, and we'll throw some weight around a little bit less than Rory, maybe.
Exactly. I don't want to hurt our backs. Thank you, Brad.
And I'll meet you guys at the bar later. And as we go to break, one more look at a much, much younger Brad Faxon. In the winner's circle back in 2001. Still a magnificent mane of hair, though. News today from Augusta National Golf Club, as Joaquin Niemann will again be in the field for this year's Masters Tournament. He and Denmark's Nikolaj Højgaard have received invitations to this year's tournament, which will take place April 10th through the 13th. And of course, Nikolaj briefly held the lead on the weekend at the Masters last year.
Well, that was last year. How about this year? Take a closer look at the venues. Augusta National, as always, Quail Hollow, PGA Championship, Oakmont Country Club. Got to see it at the end of 2024. It will be spicy. And of course, the Open returns to Royal Port Rush. Time now for some bold predictions for 2025 in terms of the major championships. You want to go anywhere in particular?
Well, just the conversation we had with Brad Faxon a moment ago, and then looking at those major venues, I think that Rory McIlroy will win his fifth major championship, but I think it's going to be in 2026.
Really?
Purely because of there's a millstone of pressure around his neck at Augusta every year that makes it difficult. And it's difficult to win there at the best of times. Mm. But we saw back in 2019 the pressure of performing for a home gallery in the Open Championship when it finally went back to Royal Port Rush for the first time in 68 years. And that pressure is only going to be slightly lesser for Rory McIlroy in the Open Championship this summer. It's going to be another home game. Quail Hollow, on paper, you think, OK, well, he's won three times there in what is now the Truist Championship. Well, that can work against him as well, because suddenly it becomes this expectation. Well, of course you ought to win here, because you win almost every year on this golf course. We saw it back in the 2017 PGA Championship as well. This expectation, well, this ought to be something really good for Rory McIlroy because he plays this golf course so well. I think the burden of expectation that is going to be placed on him that we see every April at Augusta, we are also going to see in May in Charlotte, and we're going to see it in July.
But he's been through it already now. I think he's...
Doesn't get any easier, though.
I think, you know, Tom Brady, one of the great things he would do is he would project what would happen. I'm going to hear this boo here. I'm going to have this emotion there before the game even started, so there was no surprise. I think the fact that Rory has been through the gauntlet of emotion at Port Rush and experienced the PGA in 2017, I think it will help him. But if he doesn't win a major, you know who's going to win a major? How about Sahith Theegala, who finished T9 at the Masters back in 2023, who finished T12 at the PGA last year, who's competed now in a President's Cup, one of the great lag putters in the game. Young Sahith will break through in 2025.
Maybe the most unheralded world number 13 we've ever seen. I mean, he's
yeah.
rocketed up the rankings
he
at
has.
This point. But he's also figured out how to play aggressive and how to get the ball in the hole.
Yes.
And there's no back off in that guy at all. I hope you're right that he does win a major because he's great entertainment value to
watch. Everything is fresh and new for him. He just has a wonderful attitude when it comes to being a professional on the PGA Tour. Well, when golf today continues, it's an emotional week in Hawaii as friends and loved ones celebrate the life of PGA Tour winner Grayson Murray, Grayson's close friend Jeff Manis joins us next as he begins a new role leading the foundation that will honor Grayson's life, legacy, and memory. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Golf Today. As the PGA Tour returns to Wailea Country Club, we want to take time to remember last year's champion, Grayson Murray. Murray, who was open about his personal experience with anxiety, depression, and addiction, passed away on May the 25th of 2024 at the age of 30. On Monday, Eric and Terry Murray, parents of the late PGA Tour player Grayson, officially launched the Grayson Murray Foundation in their son's honor. The mission of the Grayson Murray Foundation is to raise awareness and support of mental health and addiction challenges faced by individuals from all walks of life. The foundation aims to create a noticeable impact on mental health and addiction care by supporting innovative research, expanding access to essential services, and fostering a culture of understanding inspired by Murray's legacy of compassion, resilience, and hope. Yesterday, our Rich Lerner spoke with a very special guest.
Joined now by Murray family friend and a spokesperson for the Grayson Murray Foundation, Jeff Manis. Jeff, thank you for being with us. Sorry for your loss. I just want to begin here. Why was it important for you, Jeff, to be a part of this foundation?
Yeah, so thanks for having me on, Rich. It's good to talk with you. I had a long relationship with Grayson. I met him with my son, Will, at our local country club when he was about 14. My son and Grayson began to play golf, and I played golf with Grayson, and over 15 years, we developed a very close personal kinship and a special relationship. And so for me personally, you know, I played a lot of roles in Grayson's life. I just frankly recently retired from a long career, and it's just serendipitous, frankly, that I have some time to help the family stand up the Grayson Murray Foundation, is given my background in business. It is very important for us really to continue Grayson's legacy. He was a very generous person. His public persona at times, very fiery. You know, life wasn't always easy for Grayson out there, but he was very generous and had a very strong, caring attitude to help people. He suffered deeply from his experience with anxiety and depression. And so we look to carry forward his generosity to help others with this foundation.
What will the foundation, Jeff, focus on?
Yeah, the mission here is to focus on people from all walks of life that suffer and have experiences with anxiety and depression and addiction. We have a lot to learn from Grayson's life. The family is willing to share. I'm willing to share more about Grayson's life so that we can learn and really to transition our grieving from the last 8 months since his passing to growth. Our goal is to help others. And so that's really the mission. We're just getting started here. We just got approval last week from the IRS for our 501c3. We launched this week with a press release. In 2025, we'll be really focused on fundraising and beginning to look at programs that we can make a difference in the mental health arena.
Jeff, what kind of support have you received from the golf community?
Well, the golf community has been amazing. I want to continue to say that Jay Monahan and the PGA Tour in particular have been amazing to this family. From the moment of Grayson's passing on May 25th, and my call with Jay Monahan, he has never left the side of this family. They have been amazing supporters with their assets to help the family, the players. The outpouring of support has been amazing. We felt the love this morning at a celebration of life here on the beach at the Sony Open. There were dozens of players there, along with the commissioner, other executives from the PGA Tour. Can't say enough about what they've done for the Murray family.
Jeff, that golf family that has embraced all of you so warmly extends to those who are watching right now, our audience. How can people at home get involved?
We appreciate that question, Rich. We think it's important for us to share Grayson's story. We invite people to visit our website, the www.graysonmurrayfoundation. Learn more about Grayson's story there. There's the ability to make a charitable donation. We're at the ground floor of a charity here, a new 501c3 foundation, and our focus will be on fundraising. We look to raise capital here in Grayson's name and then to do some good here to help others that experience depression, anxiety, and addiction, similar that Grayson, you know, battled through his life.
Jeff, as we wrap this up, maybe you'll leave us with your favorite memory of Grayson, one that, you know, for the rest of your days will make you smile.
Wow. There's so many memories, Rich. We were we were at the breakfast table here with Kevin Canning, Grayson's longtime agent, and Jay Green, his caddy, here at the Sony Open last year, and we were sharing stories. You know, Grayson spent and Jay Green, just before Grayson's passing, spent time at my house in Raleigh, North Carolina. And we had, you know, some special words together during that, it was the last time I saw Grayson alive. I will always cherish that time. Grayson spent a lot of time at my house. He had many meals with us. We miss him, you know, incredibly. You know, I just, you know, as I think about, you know, the most precious time would be the last time I was with him. I remember him sitting in my recliner, and we were joking about various things that had occurred. The other thing I will say, Rich, is, you know, Grayson had always promised us that when he made it to the Masters that we would come along. And my wife, Mary, and I spent the whole week at the Masters this year with the Murray family. I've never seen Grayson happier. He made the cut on the number, if you remember that crazy day on Friday. His plus six actually made the cut. We had a special time there. That memory will last us forever.
Jeff, hold on to those memories and continue to push forward with this foundation. Try to help people who might be struggling as Grayson did. We thank you so much, Jeff. Wish you nothing but the best with the Grayson Murray Foundation going forward.
Thank you, Rich.
And yesterday on site at the Sony Open, Grayson's parents, loved ones, friends, and some tour players gathered in a celebration of life in remembrance of Grayson Murray.